Let me give you just a foreshadow of what it is that we will be reading about in 1 Corinthians and then over into the first part of the second chapter as well. Paul is telling us where real power and real wisdom come from. He is doing so in writing to those who live in Corinth, which was one of the most worldly cities in all of history. A citizen of Corinth would be comfortable among those who exercised authority, influence, power, and status. But he or she would also be quite comfortable among the wise people, the educated, the learned. In other words, power becomes for Paul here the singular characteristic of the Jew, and wisdom becomes the singular characteristic of the Greek. As we read this passage, look for how Paul repeats again and again in various ways his point. Jews are impressed with power. Greeks are impressed with wisdom. Together, they become prototypes of you and me. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning at verse 17, please. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has God not made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through its wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what was preached to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and sanctification and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not rest on the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Thanks be to God for His word. You may be seated. Pray with me, please. Lord, in the next few moments, would you show us that the weakness of the cross is stronger than the strength of men, and that the foolishness of the cross is wiser than the wisdom of men. And may you apply this to our hearts in such a way that we side with the powerless and the weak when necessary, in order to identify with Jesus. For we pray in His name. Amen. Many of you have seen the magazine, the beautiful, slick magazine called Vanity Fair. I have picked it up a couple of times because a cover story looked interesting or there was something that I wanted to read in it. What you may not know is that the name Vanity Fair goes back to a 19th century novel written by a man named Thackeray. And behind that, it goes back to the place cited in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress called Vanity Fair. And as the magazine title suggests, it is a magazine intended for the influential, for the wealthy, for those who have aspirations in those directions. This is the message of the publishers and the advertisers of that magazine. It's a message they work hard to cultivate, a message that comes through every article, every feature, every advertisement. They really want you and I to know that what really matters in life is a very thin slice of the population, the influencers, the clever, the beautiful. Looking through Vanity Fair, I felt as if I was very deliberately being teased by unknown editors and ad managers. And the tease went something like this: are you like him? Can you go there? Are you this sort of person? For reasons that I'll explain, I did a Google search on the word vanity. And what I discovered on the internet was the equivalent of what you used to find in an old library. Not a dictionary that you would pull off the shelf, but one of those huge reference dictionaries that would be out on a big table. The dictionary was so large that you really couldn't lift it. It was open all the time and would swing around on a lazy Susan. Huge dictionary. And in this particular internet dictionary, vanity was described as exaggerated self-love, inflated pride in oneself or in one's appearance, attainments, performance, possessions, or successes, as hunger for praise or admiration. The resource I found on the internet was so complete that it included quotations, some of them famous, some of them not quite so famous, which used the word vanity and explained it in context. For example, from Bertrand Russell: love of the good opinion of others, which we call vanity, is a desire which man shares with many animals. And then from someone named J.C. Powys: his wounded vanity turned and turned upon itself. Interesting insight. And another fellow named Carl Van Vechten talked about the epitome of maleness with all its vanity and self-importance. Corinth was a city where Vanity Fair would have sold well. It was, by any account, an impressive place in its day. Its population consisted of 250 free people, plus as many as 400,000 slaves. It was the chief city of Greece in many ways. In terms of commerce, it was a crossroads between those who were moving goods from west, from Italy and Spain, to the east, those who were moving goods from the eastern countries back west toward Asia Minor and Europe. In terms of culture, though it did not have a university like Athens did, which was just a couple of hours away, I suppose, people were nevertheless steeped in Greek philosophy. They understood their heritage well. In terms of religion, Corinth had 12 temples to Greek gods and goddesses, the most famous of which was the temple of Aphrodite, the goddess of love, where up to 1,000 temple prostitutes at a time encouraged sexuality in the name of religion. But there were many other gods as well. There was a sense of spiritual openness, an interest in the novel, in the new spiritual ideas. The postmodern everything culture, spiritually, in which we live today, would have been right at home in Corinth, I suspect. It was a worldly city, if there ever was one. There was an ambiance about it that breathed a kind of sophistication, a place where the powerful and the successful would choose to live. You wouldn't live out in the country if you didn't have to. You would move as quickly as you could to Corinth. A man or a woman of Corinth would be comfortable with the exercise of authority and power. Such a person would be impressed with position, status, wealth. They would have eagerly sought political, economic power. They would have known how and where and why and when, very subtly and in a sophisticated way, to use such power. And without any racial bias intended, Paul identifies such a person as Jewish, a person who wanted and used power. But also, the man or woman of Corinth would enjoy the atmosphere of intelligent conversation. The wise person referred to in chapter 1, verse 20, for example, would have been the Greek sophist or the debater of his age, as Paul calls him. He probably means here a person who was an intellectual, or at least a pseudo-intellectual, a person who would have enjoyed high-level dinner table conversation, a person who probably did go to the University of Athens for a few years before moving back, a person who would like to hang around Barnes and Noble bookstores. He or she would be well-read and wouldn't mind showing off what they had learned. This is the kind of person that Paul characterizes as the Greek. Now, when a man or a woman in Corinth would turn to his or her religious life, the same sort of rules would apply. They are either Jewish or Greek in their orientation. Paul says that in terms of religion, for example, a Corinthian may be Jewish in the sense that he or she would be looking for the powerful and the miraculous. For them, their God must be an influencer. They want a powerful God who will be at their disposal, who will also be impressed with their human displays of power and ingenuity and creativity. A God who would work signs either on his own or by the agency of forceful human initiative taking charge. The modern Jewish Corinthian our imaginary reader of Vanity Fair would want God to a God who was impressed with man's demonstration of power and influence. A God who would define success more or less in modern terms, as we would. But the Corinthian man or woman might also be Greek in terms of their religion, which would mean that they would demonstrate a kind of sophisticated reason when they approached their faith. They wanted rational explanations that would appeal to the Greek sense of order. The modern Corinthian would expect that God would be logical, by which he means that God would fit into his categories of Greek logic. Ancient and modern Greeks would be impressed with what Paul calls in chapter 2, verse 4, persuasive or plausible words. It's a very Greek idea. Words have power based on their logic. That's a Greek notion. The Apostle Paul would have fit into Corinth very well, you know. His hometown, Tarsus, was halfway between Jerusalem and Corinth. He was a Pharisee with all the right background in terms of influential power connections in the Jewish religious establishment. He was skilled as a debater, and he was tutored in all the logic of the rabbis and the Greek sophists. But here's the hinge upon which this passage turns. As a man of worldly power and wisdom, Paul does a remarkable and even, we might say at first, ununderstandable or foolish thing when he approaches the Corinthians. Something that we may even describe as culturally irresponsible. He chooses not to use the arguments at his disposal. He chooses not to use the demonstrations of power, which he might, and in other cases, did use. Instead, he chooses to speak the simple message of the cross, rather than in the language of sophisticated Pharisees or sophists. Paul says to the Corinthians, chapter 2, verse 1, "And when I came to you, brothers, I did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom." In fact, he says he felt weak in their presence, chapter 2, verse 3, "And I was with you in weakness and fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not plausible with words of wisdom." He seems to indicate that he knew his message would not impress them. It wasn't plausible. It wasn't logical in the Greek way. What was his message? His message was the cross. Chapter 2, verse 2. "For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." Now, may I simply say, for you to keep your tentacles out here in the next few minutes on this particular issue, note Paul did not say, "I preached Christ among you," which would not have been wrong for him to say, and indeed he does say words similar to that in other places. But here he says, "I preached Christ crucified to you." He preaches the cross. It's not just Jesus. It's not just the grace or goodness or love of Jesus. It's not just that I can have a relationship with Jesus. This is not the subject matter that Paul is after in this case. He preaches to them a message of the cross, the Christ crucified. And into the Corinthian world of Vanity Fair, Paul's message of this cross looks terribly, but I will tell you deliberately in the mind of Paul, out of place. The problem isn't that it's an old-fashioned message. The problem is that it's weak and it's foolish among the world of the powerful and the wise. Surely you have had the experience in a business meeting or in a social gathering. Someone says something about Jesus Christ to which you feel you should respond. You know that they have either said something that is so wrong that it shouldn't just hang out there without a response. Or they have said something that invites a response on your part. And I also know that 8 times out of 10, you say nothing. Because in the midst of the world of Vanity Fair, you do not want to appear weak and foolish. You see, the problem with the message of the cross is that it doesn't fit the lives that are shaped by Vanity Fair. The ancient Corinthians would have been offended on 2 counts. One, the cross was a symbol of defeat, not of victory of strength. Much more in this time, in this first century, than even now. The cross was a symbol of pitiful misfortune, suffering, and death. You didn't wear little crosses around your neck in these days. It was a Roman form of execution. We don't envy those who are to be executed. The cross is a symbol of a mismanaged life, a life that got out of control, a life that got in trouble, a life that maybe started out well but wasn't well managed. And forgive me, but it's a little bit like Martha Stewart's life. What happened? In short, you see, the cross is a sign of unwelcomed weakness. Powerful people, those who seek to influence others, avoid that kind of weakness. And Christ was not by such measure influential. Christ crucified is a sign of weakness, not of power. The second reason that the Corinthians would have been offended at the cross was that it was foolish. The message of the cross was barbaric. It was unappealing. It was messy. It did not appeal to the sophisticated logic of the Platonic Greek mind that wanted to keep spiritual thoughts lofty and high. It was fleshly and ugly and bloody. In fact, it would be downright stupid for a person to enter into such a religion if they were a Greek. But Paul knows that though the man or the woman of the world can do many things, there is one thing such a person cannot do. They cannot come to know God. In the wisdom of God, the world did not come to know him through its wisdom, Paul says. And for all of the influence and all of the ingenuity and all of the power and all of the wisdom, all of the many good things that people can do, and people can do many good things, I have no doubt. But they cannot find their way to God by their power or their wisdom. The Corinthians could create intriguing religious systems. They could have assumptions about the spiritual world order, about right, about wrong, but they could not know God. And for this reason, Paul deliberately does not present himself in the mode of the Greek orator or debater. He does not come as the one to debate. He comes as one to announce something. The right word is herald. That is the posture he takes. He was convinced that the power of his message, the convincing power of the cross, could not be fully manifested if in its communication it was shown too evidently to be the device of human rhetoric. You see, Paul is looking for the right foundation for their faith and ours. In chapter 2, verse 5, it says, that your faith may not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. He anticipates that faith could rest on the wisdom of man, but he knows that faith that rests on a clever argument is susceptible and at the mercy of an ever more clever argument. In chapter 1, verse 20, he says this, where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has God not made foolish the wisdom of this world? Paul knows that God discounts the wisdom of the wise and sets aside the cleverness of the clever because he knows the clever wisdom of the world will yield up something other than the knowledge of God. And Paul says in chapter 2, verse 2, that every preacher must decide that which reveals God. He must decide to know that which reveals God. A sober judgment, reflectively made. His determination is not to use Greek sophistry, though he may do otherwise. A preacher's decision is ultimately not one to use all of the argumentation open to him and available to him on the front page of every newspaper every day. It is not even to use the form of logic inherent in Western rationalism. It is rather to take the position, the unique position of a herald, of one who says there is only one way to know God, and it is not only by Jesus, but it is by Jesus on the cross. Paul knows that the meaning of his message, to quote one old commentator named Lightfoot, would dwindle to nothing under the weight of rhetorical argument and dialectic subtlety if he did otherwise. Now, mind you, Paul is not afraid of argument. We see that in Acts 17. We see it in many places where he would argue for hours in the theater of Tyrannus. We know that the Apostle Paul was prepared to argue. But Paul knows that at the end, if men and women are persuaded by rhetorical skill, then they will not be persuaded by Christ crucified. So Paul not only says he's determined not to speak or preach or talk about anything else, he says he is determined to know nothing else among you except the cross. And in the Vanity Fair of Corinth, Paul decided to talk about just one thing. Paul, have you lost it? Paul, don't you know who you're speaking to? These are graduates of the University of Athens, Paul. These are people who have built the beautiful glass towers of Corinth. These are sophisticated, commercial, intelligent, bright people. It's important to communicate carefully to your culture, Paul. Paul, your monotone is too pious, it's too stiff. We're Greeks. You need to tease us a little. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be relevant. There's nothing wrong with beginning with an illustration from a popular magazine like Vanity Fair in order to try and capture your attention. The question is where the preacher goes with it, where he leads you. The problem is that for some, in the way we understand the gospel, we never get beyond the immediately relevant, the immediately visible. Yes, the gospel needs to speak to society, and it does, and to the issues of our time, and yes, it does. And God enabled Paul to speak this gospel in such a way that for 2,000 years it has been doing precisely that. But ultimately the message is relevant because it focuses on the one thing the world in its wisdom cannot discover. Chapter 1, verse 21. For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. Paul saw that there was a power and a wisdom in the weak and foolish message of the cross that could do what no Corinthian could do for himself. It could open the way to knowing God. Let me tell you something. Our brother Bob Simmons has been in Zale Lipsey Hospital, I think, about a dozen times in the last 18 months. Do you know that the people in Zale Lipsey Hospital say that when Bob is there and Cindy is there caring for him, that the atmosphere of the whole seventh floor where they stay and really of the whole hospital changes? And do you know that it is because they speak of Christ to everybody? The doctors come in with their sophisticated diagnoses. The doctors come in with their predictions, with their ideas, with their long faces. And Bob and Cindy speak about their faith in Christ crucified. And it makes all the difference in the world. You see, Paul says he deliberately chose to do this. He intended to do it because he saw it as a sort of trade-off. If you look at chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, again, either he would speak plausible words of wisdom, wise, persuasive words, or his words would be a demonstration of the Spirit's power. You can't have it both ways. You cannot have it both ways in the end. Either plausible logic according to the culture to which you're speaking, or the word of the cross. And he goes even further. He says that if you rely on human wisdom to lead you to God, you nullify the power of God. Chapter 1, verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. I find this tremendously challenging and even frightening. To the extent that I rely on clever rhetoric as a preacher, to that extent I just might be compromising the only power that will save you and me. Christ, in his weakness on the cross, is stronger than man. For no man is strong enough to tear down the wall of separation between men and God that sin has created. Christ, in the foolishness of the cross, is wiser than men, for he knows what none of us know. He knows the way to God. A stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Greeks, Paul calls it. But it's what I need. And it's what you need. a message. Words. Jesus Christ died on the cross that I might live forever with Him. When the doctors in the cancer patient's room are sure medically you're going to die, those words will do their work. Believe me. Paul tells us that the deepest realism is humility. Humility. Chapter 1, verse 26. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what was weak in the world to shame the strong. Even by human standards, if we're honest, we're not that spectacular. But God needs to remind us that our vanity is vain. Some of you know of the little baby Paul Delahunty, 4 years old, that died a little over a week ago. We had his memorial service a week ago this afternoon in this room. Packed. The room was packed with friends and family and loved ones. This little boy, disabled from birth, never grew very much bigger than this. He could not see. He could not move. He could hear a little bit, but that was about all. And we talked about mighty little Paul. The word Paul actually means little. And the idea is that in his littleness and his weakness, he was mighty because he taught a lot of people the way of humility and the way to God. If you boast before men of your power and your wisdom, then in the end, you will not know God. Did you hear me? If you live in Vanity Fair, if that's your life, in the end, you cannot know God. But if you come to see that really, all things considered, you're not even wise by human standards. If you come to see that compared to God, we're all like Paul Delahunty. We're all helpless. We're all unable to see. We all can barely move. If you see that, then you are on the highway to life. Robert Coles is a very famous Harvard psychologist. In the 1960s, he studied the civil rights movement in the South. His expertise was and is children, and he wanted to know the particular effects of the civil rights movement upon black children. So he went down to Alabama and he interviewed black children. And he interviewed this one little girl, 8 years old, named Annie. And when Annie would go to school in those days, she would be spit upon, and things would be thrown at her. And people would yell at her as she walked up the steps to her elementary school. And Robert Coles wanted to figure out what made Annie tick. And so he went home with Annie day after day and would interview her. And Annie said over and over again something like this: Dr. Coles, Jesus died for me on the cross. Now I can do anything for him. And this sophisticated Harvard psychiatrist became a Christian because of the human instrument of an 8-year-old black girl from rural Alabama. And if you read Robert Cole's writings to this day, his more modern writings, you will see the depth and the reality of Christ crucified in his life. I told you that I used an internet dictionary to look up the word vanity. You may know that the root word to vanity is vain, which means empty. The quality of being empty, something that is empty, it said, valueless or unprofitable. Christ sent me, Paul said in verse 17, to preach the gospel not with words of human wisdom, lest the cross be emptied of its power, lest the cross be made vain by my words. You cannot have it both ways. Either the world impresses you as Vanity Fair, and the cross is an empty thing, or you see the world as empty fair and vain, and the cross of Christ is the most powerful and the most wise thing you can know. You cannot have it both ways. You cannot have it both ways. It is Vanity Fair, or it is Christ crucified. God help us.